Cam found out that group chats between different phones aren't private.
Or encrypted,
thank you. We only text in code.
Yes, which I created. I created a code.
Yes, which can be a little annoying.
Wait, was that your attempt at the code?
You already forgot the code, didn't you?
I should have written it down.
The place to safely send messages between different devices. WhatsApp. Message privately with everyone.
Welcome to another round of Drawing Board or Miro Board. Today, we talk brainstorms with UX designer Brian. Let's go. First question. You thought you'd see everyone's idea in the team brainstorm, but you've got a grand total of one. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, the team can add ideas now or later. And with Privacy Mode, we can keep them anonymous until they're good to share.
Correct. Next, you need the best way to explain your idea, but all you have is a few sticky notes. Drawing Board or Miro Board?
Drawing Board. In Miro, I could record videos, add text, images, links, and digital sticky notes, of course.
Right again. Now, you're looking for a past idea you thought was just genius. Only you could find... Oh, there it is. Drawing Board or...
Miro. All our finished and unfinished work lives in one place.
And he's won.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/brainstorm now and get a free business plan trial to unlock even more brainstorming tools like private mode and voting. That's Miro.com/brainstorm now.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Crux True Survival Stories. I am your host, Casey McIntosh, and Julie Henningsen is going to be leading the story for us today. Hey, Julie.
Hi, Casey.
Hi.
Following the theme of it being 95 degrees outside, I have a story today that involves cold and wintertime and snow and hypothermia and all of the things that are hard to relate to this time of year. So this is the story of Jim and Jennifer Stolpa and their five-month-old son, Clayton, whose truck broke down in the Nevada wilderness in December, and they were stranded for 6 days waiting for rescue. This is an amazing survival story, and it's an older one. This happened in 1992, so quite a long time ago, but might be familiar to folks that were alive and paying attention to news media in 1992, because it was a big deal. But let me tell you just a little bit about Jim and Jennifer. Jim Stolpa, at the time, was a 21-year-old Army private, and he was married to Jennifer Stolpa, who was 20 years old, and they lived in California. They just had their first baby, Clayton, about 5 months ago, and the story really starts when Jim lost his grandmother, who lived in Idaho. His grandmother passed away, and he was a real family-focused guy. He was close with his parents, close with his grandparents, and it was just one of these things there where there was nothing was going to stop him from driving up to Idaho to get to his grandmother's funeral. That felt like priority number one for him that day, even though his mom had tried to talk him out of it, because there were a lot of weather warnings at that time in late December of 92. Many interstates were closed, blizzard warnings. They just knew going into it that the road conditions were really not good. Jim's parents had tried to talk him out of making the trip with the little baby, and they didn't have a lot of time to make the trip, but they weren't going to get talked out of it. So they packed up their truck and hit the road. And of course, in 1992, this was before cell phones and GPS and all of the things that we rely on now to navigate and communicate. They were headed out of the San Francisco Bay Area towards Pocatello, Idaho, and they stopped and bought a paper map. They knew Interstate 80 was closed, and they knew some other major roads were closed as well because of these blizzards. So they just unfolded the map and looked and found some skinny little lines indicating roads that looked like could be a reasonable alternative route. but they didn't give a lot of attention to what those roads might actually be like or what kind of terrain the roads were traveling through. They just picked her out.
The other thing too is like we take for granted how easy it is now to just Google search something, to put something into your phone and be like, what is this? You can do research so much easier now than you were able to then. How would you get that information? Going to the library? I don't, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I don't know. Calling AAA. I remember as a kid before we had all these resources, we'd call AAA and they would mail us maps with literally a highlighter on a paper map of a route. But you have to do it a month in advance. And yeah, I don't know. They didn't have the resources. And I think they probably weren't familiar with the route in general. I think they maybe never made that interstate drive and forethought about the mountains and the winter and all of the things that the internet helps provide us information on now. So they're feeling pretty good. They wanted to make really quick time because they knew Jim's mom was worried about them. So they just wanted to get there, mostly so that she didn't have to worry, which is ironic. And as they're driving, they can see some dark skies, some weather coming in from the west. And there started to be a little bit of snow. So they pulled over to a service station and put chains on their truck. I think they had got some help putting chains on their truck. So they're feeling like they were prepared for a snowy road. And they got back on the road. But before long, the road was actually clear. There was no snow at all. It was bare. And they were driving down the road with these bulky chains on over completely bare road. So of course you can imagine they had to go pretty slow and they were thinking, we don't need to be using these chains. So after a period of time, they decided, okay, we're going to pull over again and take the chains off. So they did that. And now they're back on the road, which at that moment was bare with no chains, heading down the highway, and it's starting to get dark. It's coming on nighttime.
How many miles is this trip? How far did they have to go?
Yeah, great question. They were trying to go about 1,000 miles. It was a 1,000-mile trip for them. And it's unclear to me. It almost sounds like they were actually thinking they were going to just drive through because there was no mention of, oh, we're going to pull over for the night or we're going to stay in a hotel at this location. I think they were just going for it.
So you're looking at about 16 hours of driving if you're making good time and everything goes as you plan.
Yeah. So yeah, they've got a few strikes against them already with the weather, the time of year, the terrain. Yeah. And just all of the unknowns. And I just think like they were 20 and 21 years old, new parents. They were young. So not a lot of life experience, I imagine, to help them navigate some of these challenges. Before too long, the snow picked back up pretty quickly, picked up with a vengeance, and they were now in what felt like a full-blown blizzard, no chains on their truck, just making their way as best they could on this side back road. And it was dark, so they really didn't have a feel for how traveled this road was. And on the map, it's just a line. But in reality, what they didn't realize is a while back, the road had gone from paved to gravel. And the road was leading straight into a wilderness area.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So they just didn't have good visualization to the extent that they actually passed a sign that said the road is closed. And the sign was almost completely covered in snow. So they didn't see it. They didn't know it was there. And now they're on a closed gravel road in the middle of the night in a snowstorm headed into the Nevada wilderness and not aware of that. So they do start to notice that there's no longer any tracks on the road in the building snow. The snow they're driving in is getting deeper. And they just did get a sense, an inkling that this didn't feel right. Before they broke down, or actually I should say before they got stuck in the snow, it occurred to them that this was not right. Maybe they thought they took a wrong turn. And so they were considering backtracking a bit when, sure enough, they did get stuck in the snow. They thought about putting the chains on, but they thought we wouldn't be able to do that without tools that they didn't have and in the night and in the snow. They just didn't think that was practical to pull over and try and do that. And so they didn't, which is how they ended up getting stuck. The wheels were just spinning and spinning as they tried to go forward, go in reverse. They were augured in with no way out.
That sounds absolutely terrifying, especially because you have no lifeline. And I've driven in snow, like the snow you're describing. I went to my friend's birthday in Hamilton this past winter, and even on a road that I knew, which was not in the middle of nowhere, I thought, there's really nothing out here. There's nowhere to stop. There's nowhere to pull over. And even if you're not in the middle of nowhere, you can end up in a really serious situation if you're stuck in the snow.
Yeah, even just a night out in the snow and you're going to get found in the morning or somebody's going to be there to help you. But just the thought of sitting in your cold car, waiting that out. I've had similar feelings of trepidation about nighttime winter travel.
Yeah, when you're driving like 10 miles an hour and the snow is falling so hard that you can barely see the road anymore.
Yeah, it's just coming at you like a hyperspace in Star Wars when the Millennium Falcon goes into hyperspace mode.
I love that you say that because that's always what I'm thinking when I'm driving in those snowy conditions.
Yeah, same. Okay, it took them a while to figure out the magnitude of their situation. They were thinking, you know what? People get stuck in the snow all the time. We'll get help tomorrow. Somebody will find us. We'll find a way out. We just need to hunker down, spend the night in the truck, and we'll figure it out in the morning. So that's what they did. They had spent a cold, anxious night in the truck trying to sleep. And then the next morning, they thought, let's first just try and dig out of this snow that we're in. So still having no chains on the truck, they got out of the truck and started shoveling snow around the truck with bare hands and with cups that they had in the car. And the snow was really dry. It was dry snow. So it was just like falling right back in wherever they shoveled it out. And it was futile to try and dig the snow out at all. They stuck with that all day. They tried all day to dig the truck out, but just made no headway, gained no ground at all. They really couldn't get it to move or get any kind of a upper hand on their burial in the snow. They were still hopeful that somebody might notice them or somebody might drive by. Because remember, they still don't know that they drove past the sign that said the road was closed. So that in their mind, they're thinking, oh, someone's bound to come along. Or maybe a plane overhead will fly by and notice them. So their focus when they realized they weren't going to get themselves out of the snow was to just do the best they could in the truck. And they've got the baby who's still breastfeeding at this point. Clayton's 5 months old. He's just starting to do solid foods. So they had some little snacks that they brought for him, but Jennifer's nursing him and they're keeping him warm. He has his own little sleeping bag. They did each have a sleeping bag in the truck. So they use some old clothes and different things that they have on hand to plug the drafts in the windows and the doors and try and keep as much heat in. They'd fire up the engine of the truck every once in a while, get the heat going. And they just hung out, distracted each other. They played games, played hangman, 20 questions, focused on trying to get water, trying to hydrate by melting some of the dry snow, and just passing time. So they had a empty bag of chips that had just some crumbs in the bottom of the bag and a fruit cake that they were bringing up to Idaho. And so they shared the chip scraps. Jim and Jennifer did. And then Jennifer was not into the fruitcake. She didn't want it. So Jim ate the whole fruitcake.
What?
And that was on day two. Yeah. Because they were starting to get hungry, but Jennifer was not hungry enough to consider eating fruitcake. So Jim went for it with the fruitcake. Because I think at this point, they still thought, okay, we'll be sitting in a restaurant here pretty soon.
I cannot believe that he did that on day two.
I think it just goes to show that they didn't have the full picture of what they were up against. As I mentioned, Jim's mom was really worried about him, and they were supposed to call that night and just check in. And when they didn't, she immediately started calling Highway Patrol and was really on top of it. She was already up in Idaho and was trying to muster all the resources to send out a search, to get a search started. Because she knew that something wasn't right based on the fact that she hadn't heard from him. But as you can imagine, nobody was willing to help. They were meeting dead ends at every try. The family hadn't been missing long enough. Who knows, maybe they just ran away. All of the reasons why. Oh, it was New Year's Eve, and they were very busy, and weather, and all these reasons why they couldn't initiate a search, which was really frustrating for Jim's parents. So they spent another night in the truck, and now we're on day 3, which was New Year's Eve. The temperatures dropped to about minus 10 degrees Celsius or 14 degrees Fahrenheit, so really cold. And Clayton was still nursing. Jennifer was still producing milk. They were rationing these small solid foods that they had for him, but he was hanging in there. He was just chilling and not crying or really stirring or showing too much or worrying them in any way, just along for the ride.
And what a relief that is, because you know how stressful it is to be in a car with an infant that's screaming.
Yeah, I think that was one of the themes of this whole experience, was that Clayton was like the member of the family that was keeping everybody grounded and everybody motivated and having the easiest disposition, which is so cool. So that day, New Year's Eve, Jim's parents went to his grandmother's funeral and then left as soon as they could to get back to California, where they lived as well, because Jim's dad had some media connections. And by now, they were just focused on getting a search started, alerting the media, and they felt like they'd be able to do a better job of that from home in California. And it was around this time that Jim and Jennifer started to really realize that nobody was coming for them. They were able to listen to the radio and heard that the weather was supposed to clear. And so they came around to the idea that they were going to have to do something to save themselves, that they couldn't just sit there and starve, which is what they felt like they were doing. So they pulled out the map again, and in looking at the map, as trying to figure out where they were as best they could, it looked like if they continued in the direction they'd been traveling, about 20 miles, they would intersect a busier road. And that was the closest exit point that they could determine from looking at this map.
Please tell me they do not try to walk out of there.
That's the direction this is going, I'm sorry to say. Yeah, their priority was staying together. It was really important to Jennifer that they stayed together. She didn't want to be left alone. She didn't want to be left alone with Clayton for fear that something would happen to Jim or something would happen to him. So they were prioritizing staying together. They wrote up a little will. They wrote up a little note. They indicated what they want done with their remains in case this didn't end well. Like, they were very solemn by this point, and they started to understand the gravity of the decision that they were making. But yes, Casey, they put on as many of their clothes that they could. They had brought funeral clothes, dress clothes, and sneakers, nothing that would prepare them for winter travel outdoors. But they ripped the plastic dry cleaning covering from their dress clothes and put the plastic over their socks and in their sneakers to try and create an occlusive layer to keep their socks dry. And then they wrapped little Clayton up in his baby sleeping bag with all of his layers on. And then they took a garment bag, like you can imagine, that you might get from a dry cleaner. And they zipped Clayton into the garment bag. And that was his little contraption that he traveled in. They actually dragged the garment bag on the snow behind them as they walked, with him all insulated inside there, which he seemed to be fine with. Again, he was just along for the ride. No crying, no resistance. So they head out from the truck thinking they're in for about a 20-mile hike in just snow, knee-deep snow at least, and sometimes deeper. So meanwhile, back in California, Jim's parents, they're getting some things going with the media. Their house became a command central, and there's a lot of media involved. And his dad actually borrowed a truck from a friend and hit the road and started heading to Nevada to try and look for him, to try and guess what route they might have taken and just drive the roads and hope that he could find him. So things were happening. So they're moving through the snow, trying to make their way to where they think is going to be a road up ahead. And Jim's pulling little Clayton in his garment bag, dragging him on the snow behind him. And before long, of course, their feet are numb. They're very thirsty. They're trying to eat this dry snow to get a little bit of fluid, which was like a full-time job. They had to constantly just be putting mouthful after mouthful of dry snow to get it to melt, to get any kind of liquid down. No food. And they come to a base of a big hill that they think they know where they are on this rudimentary road map that they have. And they have a suspicion that when they get to the top of this pretty big daunting hill, they'll be able to look over and see this road that they're after. So there's a combination of exhaustion and also excitement with the idea that maybe the end is near. So Jennifer's getting just terribly exhausted. She's falling behind, really having a hard time moving forward. But they push on and they climb and climb and get to the top of this hill. And the closer they get to the top, the more nervous anticipation they have about what they're going to see. And they get to the top and they peek over the crest of the hill. And sure enough, all they see for miles and miles is just snowy mountains. There's no road. There's no signs of life. Just miles more of the same. And they're crushed. They just are devastated because they really don't think they can go any further. Jennifer in particular just broke down, just completely broke down. And at that point felt like there was no chance of survival or no chance of even really getting back to the truck for her.
That is terrible.
So, yeah. So they try to regroup and they're trying to recover from this disappointment. And they realize that Clayton hasn't made any noise. Usually when they stop moving, he would fuss or fidget or get their attention somehow. And they'd been there for a while and he hadn't done anything to get their attention. So this feeling of just utter terror comes over them. And they go over to the garment bag and they're looking at each other and they're terrified to unzip the bag. But they unzip the bag and look in, and there's little Clayton, eyes open, goo, gaga, making his baby noises, and just totally fine. Just quiet and fine.
It's terrifying.
Yeah, so they're amazingly relieved, coming off devastatingly disappointed. And that combination of disappointment and relief is what kind of gave Jennifer a little bit more gusto to keep going. Because she said if Clayton hadn't been all right, she would have laid down and died right there and would have had no problem with it at all. That's what she would have wanted. But because he was seemingly doing so well, she found the energy to keep going for him. At this point, Jim points out that they know for a fact that there is a town back in the direction that they came from because they had driven through it before they got stuck. And they also know that it's probably about 50 miles from where they got stuck. They passed it 50 miles before. So that's why that wasn't their first choice, because it just was so far. But it's the only other known entity. Jim suggests that they just turn around, go back out the way they came, get back to the truck, regroup, maybe warm up, and then try and walk out again in the direction that they came in from, thinking that maybe they would see somebody on the road or that that was really their only other option at this point. Jennifer agrees. They turn around and start heading back, and she's just in rough shape. And they don't make it all the way back to the truck. The wind picks up, the temperature drops, and they realize that they need to find a place to just protect themselves from the wind for the night. So they come to this sort of rock outcropping where they can get a little bit of wind protection. And they did pull out these sleeping bags that they had and covered themselves with the bags as best they could, cuddled with each other and the baby, and waited out the night. Got a little bit of in and out of sleep here and there, but mostly freezing cold waiting out the night. The next morning, day six, temperatures had reached 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So that was about as cold as it got. And when the wind stopped in the morning, they dug out of the snow that had blown over them in the night. And Jennifer tried to stand to start walking again. And she realized that she couldn't even walk. Her hips were in a bunch of pain and her legs were shot and she couldn't even get upright. So the idea of making it further in the snow was just not going to happen for her. Her pain was excruciating. So that just made a bad situation worse and really limited any option that they had to try and stick together. So at this point, out of utter desperation with no other viable options, Jim tells Jennifer he's got to go on his own. He's going to leave her and Clayton, and they find a little cave, more of a cave than where they had spent the night, and kind of tuck Jennifer and Clayton into the cave, and they say their goodbyes. Tears are flowing. Jennifer's terrified. Her worst nightmare is getting worse because now she's going to be left, and Jim just sets out on his own, thinking he has a 50-mile-ish hike through snow ahead of him. When he hasn't eaten for 5 days, the fruitcake 5 days ago, very dehydrated. But all he can think about is his wife and his son, and he's an army private. He's had some experiences throughout his life that were probably not easy. So he has some deep reserves. And he said at this point, he just became a machine. He just went and hiked and hiked, and it felt like a never-ending task. He had placed a sweatshirt, a spare kind of colorful sweatshirt, on a tree or a rock near where the cave was to be able to find him, to come back in, and he just hit the road or hit the snow. He was just stoic and single-minded. He occasionally would sing to himself an army cadence to try and keep his rhythm going, and just kept moving forward one foot in front of the other. He was exhausted and really wanted to just lay down and close his eyes and sleep for a minute, but he didn't want to let himself sleep because he was afraid that he wouldn't wake up. That would be it. So as he pressed on back in the cave, Jennifer's trying to keep Clay hydrated. She's run out of milk at this point. She's breastfed as much as possible, but he really wasn't getting anything. So she would put little bits of snow in her mouth, melt the snow, and then spit it into his mouth. And she said he would just kind of lap it up and drink that water and lick it up like a little baby bird. So she was doing her best to take care of him, and he was still just hanging out. So finally that evening, Jim did make it back to the truck. He made it to the truck and was grateful to get in the truck and be out of the wind. He was eager to start the truck and get the heat going, but by this point the truck wouldn't even start. So he just laid in the cold truck for the night and went to sleep. And then as soon as the sun came out in the morning, he left the truck in the direction that they had drove in from. And as he was hiking out, he passed a sign that was oriented in his direction. So for somebody that would be driving in the opposite direction that they were driving, that said the nearest town was 51 miles. So he realized that he theoretically had 51 miles to walk to get to that town, which seemed impossible to him. He felt pretty defeated when he saw that sign. Back in the cave, Jennifer realized her feet were really cold, and she thought, maybe it's a good idea if I pull my shoes off and try and warm my feet. So she pulled her shoes off, and she looked at her feet, and they were black and blue. Both of her feet were completely black and blue and like wooden. And she didn't have any experience with frostbite, and she was young, so she didn't know that much about it. She didn't realize that her feet were totally frostbitten. So she went to try and warm them up a little bit, and as they warmed just a bit, the pain became so excruciating that she remembers she just put her bare feet right into the snow, right back into the snow to freeze them up again, because the numbness was the only thing that would relieve the pain.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Okay. So now by day 9, I think I said they were in there for 6 days. It was 9 days. By day 9, Jim is still walking. The road started to feel like it was a little more plowed, and he was hallucinating and really on the verge of utter collapse when he thought he saw a pickup truck. But he figured, no, I didn't see a pickup truck. I'm just hallucinating. Nonetheless, he started yelling anyways, just in case he really was seeing a pickup truck, and the truck stopped. The truck stopped and backed up, and in that moment, he realized that this was really happening. He jumped in the truck, and there's this grizzled old man behind the steering wheel, And he just told this man as fast as he could everything that happened and the fact that his wife and baby were still out there. And the man just looked at him like he was crazy. But fortunately, he ran into the right person. This guy, Dave, had a nearby cabin that he lived in. He knew the country really well. So Dave drove him back to his house slash cabin. Well, didn't have a phone, but they did have a radio. So they radioed Dave's buddy, Dusty, who was also nearby and familiar with the terrain and the area. And Dusty showed up and said he was ready to help. And Jim told Dave and Dusty about the sweatshirt and where to go to find Jennifer and Clayton. So Dave and Dusty got on a snow machine and headed out in the direction that Jim told them to go.
So Jim is just hanging out at the cabin waiting at this point?
Yeah.
Can you imagine how anxiety provoking that would be?
Yeah, no, I can't imagine at all. And I also think that's an interesting turn of events that is what ended up working. But their first response was to just jump these two guys, Dave and Dusty. Sounds like didn't really call for help or initiate a search and rescue or call backup. They just got on the snow machine and went for it, which ended up being the saving grace of this whole story. Jennifer had been sleeping and she woke up thinking that she was hearing engine noises. And she looked around and she saw this big, what she described as a bulldozer, headed her way with flashing light. And she started waving and screaming and crying. And she said it felt amazing. And they parked and walked up to the cave and she couldn't walk. They had to carry her back to the vehicle. They carried Clayton. They gave her an orange. They happened to have an orange left over from their lunch and a water bottle, which she said was like the most beautiful experience of her life, is being able to drink and eat that orange. And little Clayton was sucking on the wedges of the orange, loving every minute of it. And they drove her back to Jim, and they both ended up in a nearby hospital to recover. The California Highway Patrol agreed to fly Jim's mom to the hospital where they were. So she reunited with them shortly thereafter and was just so relieved. They were both exhausted. They were both treated for hypothermia, dehydration, and frostbite. They lost all 20 of their toes. So nary a toe between the two of them after this event. They had to have them amputated, but they kept their feet. And Clayton was also really dehydrated. He had a really bad diaper rash, but they gave him fluids for a day and he was fine. He had no lasting injuries from this event. He was a whole and just healthy baby and lived to be a father himself and lived a really normal life. So that was a huge blessing for them.
That's unbelievable how resilient kids are.
Yeah. Very resilient, even at 5 months old. This story was such a big deal at the time. They actually made a movie about it. I think it was like a made-for-TV movie or something, starring Neil Patrick Harris as Jim Stolpa in 1994. Oh. So you can watch the movie and see a reenactment of this whole story. The movie is called Snowbound, the Jim and Jennifer Stolpa story.
I don't know that I could watch it, even though I know how it ends, because there's just too much anticipation and it's a little bit intense.
Yeah, very intense. It is very intense. You throw a baby into the mix and it just notches everything up about 10 levels of intensity.
I was just thinking about Jim leaving his wife and son in that cave and how he must have just been wondering if he was ever going to see them alive again.
Oh, yeah. Must have been the hardest thing he'd ever done, second to walking 50 miles in plastic bags and dress shoes in the snow.
That is brutal.
Yeah, brutal. Moral of the story, don't trust paper maps. Use your technologic resources and road updates and webcams and all of the things we have to help you decide your route when you're winter driving.
Right. And I think just not necessarily trusting your navigation either, using more than one source, because there definitely have been times where GPS has led people astray.
Yeah, that's true. And the other moral of the story is the one I think we always come to, which is be prepared. Pack your unplanned overnight survival kit in the back of your vehicle in the winter. Sleeping bags and food and all of the things.
Water.
Water. Yep.
Well, that was a good one, Julie. I have never heard that story. That's unbelievable that they survived.
Yeah, pretty remarkable.
Thanks, everyone, for listening to this week's episode of the Crux True Survival Stories. And again, you know, you can find us, the Crux Podcast on Instagram or thecruxtruesurvival@gmail.com. Feel free to reach out to us and have a great rest of your week. Have a good week, Julie.
You too, Casey. Thanks.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next, you need the team to act on feedback fast. So you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
For a limited time, visit Miro.com/retro now for a free business plan trial to unlock advanced retro tools like private mode, voting, and two-way Jira syncing. That's Miro.com/retro now.